Soil.
I guess that's the word of the day. And when all is said and done, plants fix dirt. Good soil is a concert. And today we've got three wonderful folks who know how to work with nature's fine tuning. Dr. Alan Williams has pioneered many regenerative grazing protocols and foraging finishing techniques. John Kempf is in the field, and his passion leads him to teach because he knows about the potential of well-managed agricultural ecosystems to reverse ecological degradations. And Dr. Rick Haney has helped bring biology back into soil testing to give farmers and ranchers a deeper view with better opportunity for profits. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio. Let's dig in. Alan, you're a sixth-generation rancher. You've consulted farmers and ranchers on all things regenerative, and you also have a history in academia. So I'm wondering if you could tell us how rampant you think the rumors are that it still takes hundreds, if not 1,000 years, to rebuild topsoil.
Well, we already know the answer to that. we're doing it ourselves. And we have many clients who are doing it. So basically, here's what we know. We have been able to repeatedly and across many different types of soil types and environments, by the way, rebuild new organic matter, new topsoil at the rate of anywhere from 0.5% to 1% a year, at least for the first 4 to 5 years. So we now know that you can build new topsoil far more rapidly than we previously thought. It just simply takes the right practices being implemented.
Yes. Across the board, how many academians and how many farmers and ranchers do you think know this? Are you satisfied or happy about how this information is being transferred around to everyone?
Anything that is relatively new in both the agricultural world and the academic world, since I have lived in both, it takes a while, right? Most things that are this game-changing, that shift paradigms, take a while for people to understand and accept. Certainly so with farmers and ranchers, because they've been told themselves their whole lives that it takes hundreds or thousands of years to add even 1% organic matter, so they quit even trying. And certainly academicians, because they themselves have also been told that and even teach that, although now we know erroneously, many of them are not going to change their minds overnight. However, what I will say is that, yes, are there scientists out there who now know this to be fact and are actively promoting and advocating the benefits of regenerative because of this? Yes. And the number of scientists is growing. The number of farmers and ranchers is growing far more rapidly, though, than the number of academicians. Farmers and ranchers obviously have the greater incentive because this is what they do as a business. And so it is sort of snowballing among farmers and ranchers. Now, admittedly, we're still at the tip of the iceberg, and so we still got a ways to go to reach a lot more farmers and ranchers. But I can say the interest and those that are actively now participating in regenerative agriculture has grown significantly over the last 10 years, and especially over the last 5 years.
Yes, beautiful. One of my favorite stories is Bob Quinn, who is a wheat grower. He was laughed at by the farmers and ranchers years ago when he'd go to the local coffee shop in the morning. He figured the best way to show that it was working for him was his farm happened to border the two major intersections, so he bought a brand new tractor and parked it out there.
I love it.
Yeah. Profits can be made. So, Alan, as I've heard you say, there's no blaming nature, and adaptability is the name of the game. But before we speak about adaptable stewardship, I'd love to hear you share what you think is key in keeping what is known as regenerative agriculture non-formulaic. I think organic has fallen into an almost meaningless wayside, and I'd hate to see the regen ag movement follow in those footsteps.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And just like with anything, unfortunately, there are already those that are trying to create some kind of formulaic or prescriptive definition of regenerative. And what we teach is exactly the opposite, that the very moment that you try to make this prescriptive or formulaic, you are at that moment now not regenerative nor adaptive, because this doesn't fit that model and never will.
Right.
We have to be able to be extremely flexible when we're dealing with farms and ranches. We're dealing with weather, we're dealing with biology on a day in, day out basis, and none of that is static, and therefore neither can our management be so. As a matter of fact, that's what has gotten us into the mess that we're in agriculture right now.
Yes.
Is that over the last several decades, we have, both as farmers and ranchers and as scientists and as industry, all of us are guilty. We all can be implicated in this, in that we have tried to come up with these prescriptive methods to be able to, quote, make things better. And every single time what happens is you hit a plateau and then you start to digress again. And so as practicing farmers and ranchers ourselves, as well as scientists, we quickly decided that the only way to really make this work well and to work well into the future is to adapt a plan that allowed us to be able to make adjustments routinely to the biological responses and the climate responses that we're experiencing on a daily, monthly, and yearly basis.
Yes, I love hearing you say that, because in mainstream press, as you know, everyone's talking carbon, carbon, carbon. Well, carbon is one thing. There's a plethora of trace elements and minerals that are all as important. And as you say, in the adaptability, there are three rules that you hold true, but you hold those as true, and then you move within that whole system to make sure everything is not only available, but known. So I'm wondering if you could run through those rules and perhaps give an example of how or why it holds true.
Would be very happy to. The three rules of adaptive stewardship are the rule of compounding, the rule of diversity, and the rule of disruption. We'll start with compounding. And what we have found, and this is directly applicable to what you just brought up about the carbon, the almost maniacal desire to make everything about carbon nowadays. Whereas what we know within regenerative agriculture is that we don't even have to focus on carbon at all. If we just simply focus on creating very positive compounding and cascading effects, carbon and all of the other issues will take care of themselves.
I know. That's so beautiful, the way nature works.
Yes,
like that.
It is. So the rule of compounding is this. In nature and biology, there are no singular effects ever. And this applies for human beings as well. Everything is compounding and cascading. And there are no neutral effects. Compounding and cascading effects are either positive or negative. You're going one way or the other. And I'll use human pharmaceuticals as an example, okay? You know, whenever we take a medication, we're prescribed something to treat what we think is a singular issue. Right,
right? The symptom.
A headache.
Yes.
High blood pressure, whatever the case may be. First of all, headaches, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, heart disease, cancers, anything you want to name, were never caused by a singular effect themselves. There were always compounding and cascading effects through your life that led to that condition. And neither is the pharmaceutical that was prescribed to you to treat that condition. Neither does it create a singular effect in your body. It creates a series of compounding and cascading effects that could be either positive or negative. And that'll vary significantly from individual to individual. You know,
absolutely,
you could
yes.
take a blood pressure medication, and I could take a blood pressure medication, and we could both be taking the exact same milligrams of the exact same drug, but it could affect you very differently than me. So that's the rule of compounding. And the same thing happens out here on our farms and ranches. So on a farm or ranch, we have all of these sides, right? We have herbicides, we have insecticides, we have fungicides and antibiotics and so on and so forth. But yet every time we use one of those, none of those are target organism specific. Every one of them not only impacts the target organism that you're going after, but it also impacts a whole host of other organisms. So we get these unintended consequences that are compounding and cascading in nature. And that's the first thing that we have to realize, is that on our farms and ranches, every decision that we make impacts more than just what we're targeting. And we have to look at not just the short-term ramifications of that, but the long-term ramifications of that, how that glyphosate or that Roundup that they just sprayed also significantly damages mycorrhizal fungi in the soil, that it harms earthworm populations in the soil, that it damages the microbial population in the soil, and so on and so forth. We teach people to think under the rule of compounding and the potential consequences of every action that you take.
Is there any singular effect that is more hidden, is something that a farmer or rancher wouldn't initially think of? They're going regen, they've got their sustainability, they're moving within that system. Is there something that you see that someone wouldn't necessarily think of initially, and then perhaps the light bulb would go off at some time, but just something that's not as obvious as another?
So the short answer is yes. And really what it boils down to is, first of all, to be successful in implementing regenerative practices, you must incorporate all six soil health principles and then the three rules of adaptive stewardship that we just talked about. You can't pick and choose among those and say, okay, I'm doing two of the soil health principles, so now I'm regenerative. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You've got to implement all of the principles and all of the rules if you want to be truly regenerative. And the other thing that is absolutely necessary to be successful in regenerative agriculture is you must learn how to be a keen observer, because what you're observing on a day-in, day-out basis is critical to making the right decisions.
Yes, absolutely, I'm sure. Now, Alan, could you give us an example, perhaps, of either your ranch farm, Joyce Farms, or with a rancher that you've worked with that really shows how diversity really is not only the spice of life, but the thing that can really create that profitability and productivity in a farm or ranch?
Yes, absolutely, I could. We could probably stay
here. I'm sure you have a million examples.
Yeah, oh, talking about this. But yes, you know, obviously we've seen many of these things on our own farm. And then Understanding Ag, our consulting company, we witness this every day. But I'll give you one or two very quick examples. One that immediately comes to mind is Adam Grady. He's a 10th generation farmer in eastern North Carolina in the coastal plains. And Adam and his family started regenerative agriculture in 2017, so not that long ago. And in 2018, they experienced Hurricane Florence in September of that year. It was a very, very slow-moving hurricane, so it dumped an awful lot of rain in a very short period of time. And Adam's farm got 8 to 9 feet of floodwater. And yet, after the floodwaters receded, in just 2 weeks after the hurricane, Adam was able to get his tractors and no-till planters or drills back into the fields and immediately start replanting because the 8 to 9 foot of floodwater had killed everything growing there, right? So he was replanting complex cover crops, and his neighbors saw him doing that, and they tried to get into their fields, and their tractors sunk to the axle.
Yes.
Whereas Adam's fields were able to hold his tractors up because the resilience built in that soil through just 2 years of regenerative agricultural practices allowed him to do that. And on top of that, and in spite of the Hurricane Florence flooding, he still saved more than $200,000 in input cost in operating his farm. So that was just phenomenal. And that experience really made Adam and his family just huge proponents and advocates. And since, they have hosted 2 soil health academies. They have hosted numerous regenerative agriculture workshops and so forth, and just taught to everybody that'll listen about the benefits of regenerative agriculture.
Beautiful. And then what about number 3, then, the rule of disruption?
Yes, very quickly, and we'll run back to number 2 real quick, the rule of diversity. And that just means that rather than having monoculture crops all the time, and we want as much diversity in the plant species that we plant as possible. Instead of having a single livestock species, we want diversity in livestock, diversity in plants, diversity in our microbial population in the soil, and so forth. And then the third, the rule of disruption, means that we have to introduce what we call planned, purposeful disruptions to keep things moving forward. When we talked earlier about regenerative agriculture not being prescriptive or formulaic, that is exactly what the rule of disruption is about, is preventing prescriptive or formulaic applications in our farming and ranching. And I often use this analogy to help people understand the rule of disruption. For an elite athlete to compete at a high level, they cannot do the same exercise routine at the same duration and intensity day after day, year after year, and continue to make progress. If they stuck with the same exercise routine, they would quickly hit a wall, and then they would digress. They would be worse in whatever their sport is. So they have to consistently change up their exercise routine to continually challenge their bodies to respond, to grow stronger, faster, more resilient, greater endurance, whatever they need for their sport. That is introducing planned, purposeful disruptions by altering their exercise routine to do that. So it's no different out here, from the microbes beneath the soil to all of the beneficial insects to the plants to the animals, birds, and so forth, you name it. We're dealing with biology. So if we can introduce planned, purposeful disruptions rather than being prescriptive and formulaic, then we find that we continue to make progress. And the most beautiful thing about that is that we find that that is what it takes to restore fully functioning ecosystems.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, beautifully said. Now, along and within that, you speak a lot about and have a lot of experience with adaptive foraging. And I'm wondering if you could just give us a moment about that.
When we talk about adaptive grazing, again, we're going to take those 3 rules, compounding, diversity, and disruption, and we're going to apply those 3 rules directly. For instance, some of the disruptions that we implement to be able to make very rapid progress in building soil and building microbial populations, building plant species and wildlife diversity, is we will purposefully alter the season or time of year that we may graze a particular area and not graze it at the same time of year every year. We will purposefully alter the height of the forage when we go on with our livestock to graze, and the height of the forage after grazing when we come off. We will purposefully alter the stock densities, so the pounds of livestock per acre that we may put into a grazing pasture or paddock. We will purposefully alter that from time to time. We will alter rest periods. You know, a formulaic or prescriptive approach may be that I'm going to come back around in my grazing rotations every 35 days. So every pasture gets grazed every 35 days in a rotation. Well, after a while of doing that, you start to digress. So we purposefully alter rest periods. There's times we may go 80, 90, 100 days or longer in rest. Or if we're out west, we may give rangeland an entire year or more of rest before we graze it again. We can introduce things that nature has used routinely, like fire. So we can have prescribed burns. Those and many more we routinely incorporate, and we alternate the disruptions as well,
right,
so that we're continually building the resiliency of the biology that's around us.
That was a lot of information. Thank you.
You bet.
And if I speak with any rancher, I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask them what their favorite steak is. So what is your favorite steak?
You know, that is a great question. Actually, my answer is probably going to be very different than most people. Most people may say a ribeye or a New York strip or a filet, but none of those. They're all great, but the steak I love the best, and actually there's two.
Okay.
One, it's called the Denver, and the Denver is cut out of the chuck or the shoulder of the animal, and it's very richly marbled, very highly flavored. And it's a steak that you can put on a grill and have it ready in 10 minutes. You know, it's a very quick to prepare. So the Denver, and then the other that I really love is called the Hanger, like a clothes hanger. It also is richly flavored and just an exquisite cut of beef. So those are my two favorites.
Oh, great. And with the amount of consulting that you're able to do and run your ranch and do all these other things is kind of a statement about Regen Ag, isn't it? That it's obviously a lot of hard work, but in a sense, it really streamlines things.
You know, it really does. And one of the biggest benefits out of the myriad benefits that we see is the fact that the quality of life for those that are practicing regenerative agriculture improves significantly, not just for them, but for their entire families. So that's probably, in all honesty, the biggest benefit for us, just to be able to see that happening, you know, with the people that we work with.
John, as with all things, once something gets named, there's a definition or formula that follows, and the same seems to be happening with Regen Ag, and the soil test appears to be king, and I was very glad to see that you've got some questions about that and some evidence that maybe it should just be a part, not leading the way.
I think even before regenerative agriculture terminology was widely known, it's kind of having its moment in the sun right now. But before regenerative agriculture, there was organic agriculture and sustainable agriculture, and obviously those are still with us, particularly organic agriculture. And they've relied really heavily on the use of a chemistry-based soil analysis to evaluate mineral profiles and to determine recommendations for fertilizer applications and soil amendments and so forth. And I think this has really given us a biased perspective, perhaps unwittingly, because whatever it is that you measure and whatever it is that you focus on, that, of course, consumes your attention.
Right.
And so we've had this chemistry-based analysis, and so that has really resulted in us evaluating soil health from a chemistry-based perspective, which is fundamentally incorrect, because soil health and producing high-yielding crops in a biological system is really all about managing soil biology. So the biological component and the geological component and the soil physical component are at least of equal importance to the chemistry component, but historically we've largely ignored them.
Right, and you also speak about the biological dynamism of soil, and if you want to go with a specific example, that would be great.
Well, historically, the mainstream model of plant nutrition has been that plants absorb simple ions from the soil solution, so calcium ions, magnesium, ammonium, nitrate ions, and so forth. And today, we are beginning to appreciate that plants actually feed on bacteria, and they consume entire bacterial cells and use bacteria. Plants farm bacteria in the same way that we farm livestock. They feed them, they care for them, they nurture them, and then they harvest them and consume them as a nutrient source and as a mineral source. And so when we develop a different perspective and appreciate that plant nutrition is really about developing biological populations and bacterial populations rather than managing soil chemistry, it gives us a whole new perspective on the value and the importance of soil biology. So I think one example that I could give is, an example that has significant detriment in today's mainstream agriculture is the use of nitrogen. So farmers purchase large quantities of synthesized nitrogen, which is produced by consuming tremendous amounts of energy and natural gas and producing ammonium. And the air we breathe is 78% nitrogen. Biology can fix this nitrogen and supply 100% of the crop's requirements without any of this energy-intensive ammonium manufacturing when we support them in these biological systems.
Yes, and certainly you've also bring up something which is key, that the fall is the time to start with the soil.
We often recommend adding microbial inoculants and kind of reinvigorating and investing in our soil's microbial population in the fall. And the reason for that is because that gives us the entire dormant period to establish a healthy microbial population. And there is perhaps less competition, if you will, with native populations which may have become severely degraded over time. So when we're trying to establish a population of a new organism in an existing ecosystem, that can be a challenge, and it's much easier to accomplish that during the fall and winter dormant season. And that then gives us a platform to get, and a foundation to get, really strong results the following growing season.
Yeah, that's such common sense. Going back a little bit to the soil testing, do you think that many farmers are relying too much on soil pH?
Well, I think any farmer that relies primarily on soil pH and that relies primarily on soil chemistry analysis has a, to use an Australian term, a blinkered perspective, a very narrow aperture, a very narrow paradigm, and he is missing out on the majority of the factors that actually influence crop productivity. Nutrient availability and plant absorption of nutrients is fundamentally a biological process, not a chemistry process.
In doing that, if you're going to help someone on their farm or their ranch, what is your first step? I would imagine there's observation and then there's intuition as well that goes along with all of your knowledge that's taken place in the biology lab or the chemistry lab, obviously, since we've been dissing that a little bit right now.
Well, yes, there is intuition involved. There is an understanding of the landscape and the and any given operation's capabilities to execute and apply. There's a lot of observation about what does disease and insect pressure look like, because all of those communicate to every disease and every insect that is present or has the potential to be present, tells us something about the crop's nutritional profile and the soil's biological profile. So does this soil have the capacity to deliver manganese? If it doesn't and the crop is deficient in manganese, we might get powdery mildew, for example. So we've been able to draw all of those correlations. To answer the question that you asked originally, when we first begin working with an operation, we conduct a very thorough assessment of what is happening in that entire ecosystem. And that assessment from a soils perspective includes laboratory analysis. And we do measure the chemistry profile using a typical CEC analysis, but we also measure more than that. So I'm not suggesting that we should avoid using that test, but I'm suggesting that by itself, it is so incomplete as to be almost completely false. And so in addition to that typical CEC analysis that so many growers are familiar with, we also conduct what is called a geological assay or a geological analysis that would be typically run by miners. This analysis measures the complete profile of all the nutrients that are present in the soil mineral matrix. And so you might discover that you only have 10 parts per million manganese on a typical soil analysis, but that in your soil reserves, you have a total of 400 parts per million manganese, or maybe you have none. And that can be really revealing to determine what types of soil amendments you truly need, or whether biology can extract the minerals that are available in the soil mineral matrix and make those available to future crops. And then in addition to that geological assay, we also run a Haney analysis, which has been developed only in the last couple of years by Dr. Rick Haney at the USDA in Texas. And it measures the nutrients that biology can deliver to the crop immediately in the short term. So it is more of a short-term analysis of what the soil's true capacity actually is.
So in looking at that, when you have the knowledge of what the short-term delivery is there something that shows what you would need to do to make that more long-term? Or is there a generic thing you would do that would create a long-term extension?
Well, you look at these three tests side by side in parallel. And if you have a geological assay that describes that you have 400 parts per million manganese in your topsoil, and the Haney analysis shows that there's only 2 parts per million available, then we recognize that this is not a chemistry problem that needs to be addressed by adding more manganese. You can't fix this problem by buying more manganese and adding more manganese. Instead, this problem needs to be solved by stimulating biology so that it accesses more of the 400 or the 800 pounds per acre that already exists and make that available to plants. So it really kind of shifts and gives us a different perspective on what is it that we truly need to add more of and what is it that we already have plenty of, but we only need to make it available. And so when we look at these side-by-side evaluations, we often discover that historically we have been applying entirely too much fertilizer, and we can significantly reduce nitrogen and potassium and phosphorus applications, but particularly nitrogen and potassium, and increase yields at the same time simply by managing them differently.
It's so amazing that the biology just takes care of the nitrogen, right?
Well, when you think about it, it is how natural ecosystems actually function.
Right. I mean,
no one is fertilizing the forest. No one is fertilizing natural ecosystems. And intriguingly enough, people who have a different opinion might say, well, that's true, but we're also not producing the high yields and we're not cultivating those ecosystems. And so they don't have the productivity that domesticated systems do. But that is actually a point against the point that they're trying to make, because when you have cultivated soils, and till the soils, you introduce oxygen, or if you have domesticated species on them, that process of exposure to additional sunlight triggers more mineralization and actually releases more nitrogen from what is present in the native soil profile. So you would think that tilled soils, well, you wouldn't think, but it's true that tilled soils actually release more nitrogen rather than less. And yet, somehow, we still have this idea that we need to buy more nitrogen when we have 35,000 tons above every acre.
So where do you stand, then, on the till-no-till issue?
I think it's a polarizing conversation that serves no one. It's not useful to have a conversation about tillage versus no-till. Instead, I believe we should have a conversation about the soil quality characteristics. Do we have soil that has a very good aggregate structure, that has good water infiltration, and that does not erode? And if we have those characteristics, and we could perhaps toss in a few others, then do we really care about whether it's tilled or whether it's not tilled? And I frame it in this way because I'm of the persuasion that there are very few universals. What is appropriate for one soil type in a certain region may not be appropriate for another soil type in a different region.
Right. Which I was going to ask you, I know you have advised many over many different acreages. Is there a way to speak about soils from the Midwest in the U.S.?
They are rich, deep, black, and fertile, and being completely wasted by growing corn and soybeans, which nobody benefits from.
I know. I was wondering, why are we growing corn now?
I mean, these are some of the most fertile soils on the globe. And we're growing corn for ethanol? seriously, is that really the highest and best use for these soils? It is a really crazy market system that has evolved.
Yes, and I also wondered about soybeans, same thing, right?
Yeah, soybeans are not used for fuel to the same degree, but you're absolutely right. When you look back at what the productivity of these soils had historically, and actually you can just forget historically, let's frame it in modern day terms. If we managed grazing grasslands with the same level of intensity as we manage our corn and soybean crops, we can actually produce more meat per acre, more consumable protein per acre with 100% grass-fed beef than we can growing corn and soybeans and going into laboratory meats. So not only are we more efficient and more productive from a protein production perspective and meat production perspective, but we also regenerate ecosystems. We have a lot more wildlife. We regenerate soil health. Essentially, what I'm talking about is going back to a modern, highly managed version of what the bison did. This is what built 14 feet deep black topsoil in the first place that we have now degraded. We know how to rebuild that topsoil. Collectively, there are enough farmers and consultants out there who have done this successfully. We know how to rebuild it, but it's not going to happen with corn and soybeans. And the other, you know, the other interesting part is that not only is 100% grass-fed beef more efficient in terms of protein and calorie production per acre than corn and soybean production, but it is also more profitable for the farmer.
Right.
However, there are a lot of other barriers to entry. There's access to marketing. There is time and labor requirements. There's a lot of other barriers that are keeping farmers from adopting this model. But the reality is it is actually more profitable for farmers today and has been for a couple of decades to produce 100% grass-fed beef than to produce corn and soybeans.
Yes, and it seems that there is a work to change over to that system, but once you establish that, then the workload seems to be less or not as intense or leaves time for something else.
Yes, that is certainly the case. There is a reduced workload after fencing and water lines and so forth have been installed. However, there is also the constant care and attention required. I mean, if you have a herd of a few hundred or a few thousand animals, that this is where animal husbandry comes in. They need to be cared for. They need to be taken care of. You can't just decide to abandon them and go to Florida for a vacation for a month, as you can with if you're growing corn and soybeans.
Oh, right. Or just have a nice big family, right? Take turns.
I'll just add a couple of quick thoughts. Regenerative agriculture has the capacity. These agricultural models have the capacity to regenerate soil health, to regenerate plant health and make plants completely resistant to all diseases and all insects and eliminate the need for pesticides. They have the capacity to regenerate livestock health, and ultimately, they have the capacity to regenerate public health as well, because when you reduce all the toxins that are in and on our food supply being introduced by agriculture, plus produce more nutritious food, what happens when you produce plants that are resistant to diseases and insects? They produce really high concentrations of all these immune compounds that, in plain English, we call essential oils. And all plants produce these compounds, and they enhance our own immune systems as well. We might recognize some of them as phytoalexins and terpenoids. Some of these compounds that you might recognize might be resveratrol in red wine, or lycopene in tomatoes, or anthocyanins in blueberries. These are all compounds that are at the foundation of a plant's immune system, and they also enhance our own immune system. Regenerative agriculture needs to also have a conversation about regenerating public health and growing food as medicine. And all of this also needs to include regenerating farm economics and rural economies, regenerating communities. And I'll add one last thought, which is that I am appreciative of the fact that as of yet, there is no definition of regenerative agriculture that defines whether a farmer is regenerative or not. Because the moment you get there to that point, now you have a binary process of exclusion rather than a process of inclusion. And regeneration is really a journey. It's not a destination. And so my desire would be for the agricultural community to embrace all moving together on this journey and accepting each individual grower and farmer where they are at this moment in time and moving forward from there.
Absolutely. And a quick question, what's your favorite steak?
What is my favorite steak? 100% grass-fed from one of the British breeds.
Rick, I've heard you mention the definition of soil quality was debated for 20-plus years, and I'm wondering, is that debate still raging? Is it still taking place?
Well, it's just a definition. You know, in the 80s and 90s, it was all about soil quality, and then I think the switch came, the light bulb came on when people started talking about soil health. They're very similar, but the thing that soil quality doesn't capture is we're talking about a biological living system. And when you hear, well, it's soil, if you have good soil quality, that doesn't really tell you anything about how healthy the soil is. And so that really caught people's eye, I think, and started to make them think differently about what soil actually is. That's a living, breathing thing and not just an inanimate object.
Right. I heard it said recently that the soil is a living thing, so it has rights. More than a corporation in my mind, anyway.
Yeah. And that is really our mission, to advance the understanding that soil actually is a living thing and we should treat it as such.
Yes. Now, when you got started and got involved with soil testing, what did you see the status quo was and what was glaringly missing?
Well, our analysis was just in the chemical realm and just had this fundamental understanding that there was more to soil than chemistry. Not that that's not a big part of it, it is, but we've always believed that the chemistry drives the system, and the reality, in my mind, is that biology drives the system. They work together, but one of them is dynamic and the other one is not nearly as dynamic. So biology is much more dynamic than chemistry.
And certainly what you're doing with the Haney soil test, can you share a basic piece about that?
I didn't get my PhD till I was 42, and I worked for farmers most of my life prior to that. And so coming off the farm gave me a little different perspective than just being straight academics. And so I watched those guys struggle every year, borrow a bunch of money, plant whatever crop that could die on them, and, you know, weather. And it was difficult to watch those guys struggle so much. And one of the most amazing things that happened in all of that was the discovery for me of soil respiration. In other words, microorganisms in the soil take in oxygen and give off CO2 just like we do. And that was such an aha moment, because it's like, wow, we can actually measure the dynamics of the soil based on how well that soil is breathing. And that was a really big deal. And we used to do a long-term incubation in the lab for that, you know, several weeks. Alan Ponsowitz came up with this, and he said, hey, I think we could do this in as little as 1 or 3 days. And so we started doing it, and sure enough, you could. And it was really well correlated with the longer-term stuff. And it's like, oh, my God. This is back in the 90s, and I thought, we are going to change agriculture with this. And then I ran smack dab into that academic science wall. And it was disheartening to me. I wanted to quit, because it's like, how do y'all not see this? And what's the health of your soil meaning? How well is it breathing? What kind of food source is it getting? And how well balanced is that food source? And that would be like the carbon to nitrogen ratio. And so these are just simple questions that I wanted to answer using nature's formula. I really wanted to try to mimic what nature was doing in the lab. And that's why we look at water extractable organic carbon, because it rains water. It doesn't rain all the chemistry that we've been throwing at soils in the lab. It rains water. And so I wanted to do it from a little bit more natural perspective, because I thought, if we can better mimic what's happening out in the field where things actually happen, as opposed to just getting the soil in the lab and testing it in various ways that it doesn't ever get tested in nature, would be a good way forward.
And so can you share an example, perhaps, of what you might find in your test and then how you share that with a farmer and then what recommendations you give? Because I know that is all part of what you do, not only the testing, but you're pretty savvy as far as what one needs to do in order to correct or to make an even healthier soil.
Yeah. For example, for nitrogen, standard testing tests for one form of nitrogen, and it's usually nitrate nitrogen, which is an inorganic nitrogen form, and it's been tested for 60 years. But the thing that got me about that was, like, this is not the only form of nitrogen in the soil.
Right.
And so why are we not testing for all this other stuff? You know, all the organic nitrogen that is water soluble. And so the focus was, we can back off on some of our fertilizer recommendations if we account for this natural system that's giving us N, P, and K that we're not accounting for right now. And so that we can reduce our need on fertilizers at some point, which helps the farmer's bottom line. For example, if you can grow 200 bushels of corn and you're putting out 250 pounds of nitrogen, what if we showed you that you could do it with 150 pounds of nitrogen? That's a pretty big financial impact. And that's really what I was after. And so you could have farm A versus farm B, and let's say the soil health calculation on farm A was 12, which is an okay number, but on farm B it's 24. Well, you're going to have more nutrients available. The microbes are going to do a better job and help you reduce fertilizer, and we can show that. Begin to back off the over-fertilization. We're not against fertilizer. We're against too much fertilizer, as shown by the dead zone in the Gulf. I mean, I don't know how much more obvious it needs to be that we're putting on too much fertilizer. The thing that really struck me also was when I started looking at fertilizer use efficiency, and you'd see a graph that showed here's increasing nitrogen on the x-axis and yield on the y-axis. And the yield would come up as you increase fertilizer and then it kind of plateau. You could keep adding it and it wouldn't improve the yield.
Yes.
And people would see that and say, yeah, everybody knows that. Well, my focus is on the control that I didn't put any fertilizer on. And so let's say at the high rate, you made 200 bushel corn, but at the control was making 100 bushel. So my question was, how did that soil provide enough nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium to grow 100 bushel corn? That's what we're missing. That's what I was after. Is let's account for that. And that was eye-opening for me. If you put on 200 pounds in, you know, you might get 45 or 50 pounds of it in the crop. So where's the rest of it go? And people think, well, it just sits there. No, nitrogen's dynamic. It doesn't just sit there. It runs off. It denitrifies. It does a lot of things. And you can't really bank nitrogen. And that was something that everybody seemed to think was happening.
So it's kind of like vitamin C in the body. You use what you can, and then the rest goes right out.
Exactly. It was really more a push towards, let's be more efficient. Let's put the right amount on and not too much.
So when you're talking fertilizer, I'm sort of cringing. You're not putting poison in the ground, are you?
It's a difficult, because there's a lot of people living on this planet right now. And it takes X amount of nutrition or N, P, and K to grow that food. And if you just stop using fertilizer tomorrow, the yield would drop and things would change. And I think the point is, let's be more efficient, just as a first step.
Okay. And then what about the cover crops? Now, when you do your tests, would behoove you to have X amount or X percentage of legumes and X percentage of grass? How does that get figured out?
If you've got a high seed-to-end ratio, then we're going to suggest more legumes to bring that seed-to-end ratio into a better balance. Or if you've got too much nitrogen in the system, we're going to try to get you to get more grasses in the system so that it starts to sequester that nitrogen. So you're basically turning it from an inorganic form into an organic form via the plant. And that's how nature does it. And the cover crops are the key, in my opinion, to the future of agriculture. The Midwest, before we planted up in the 20s and 30s, you know, was a mixed species cover crop, and the bison moved through there. The system worked. That's why the Midwest is so fertile. We can bring it back because plants actually herd microbes. They attract them. They cultivate them.
Now, when we spoke about water a little bit earlier, now, water solubility, of course, is key. And could you give us an example of what the test shows and then how a bad result is remedied?
Yeah, so many tests that are currently used, they test for organic matter or organic carbon. And that's a test where you actually take a little piece of soil and put it in a machine, and it combusts it and gives you the amount of carbon. And that's great. We were more interested in the food, because organic carbon in the soil is a huge pool of carbon. We were more interested in what happens when it rains. So we extract the soil with water, and then run an organic carbon analysis on it, because that's the food the microbes are actually working with. The analogy I use is you can have a big house with no food in it, or a small house with a lot of food. You probably survive better in the small house. And what we want to see when a farmer or rancher switches from conventional agriculture to a more regenerative approach, we want to see those levels come up. We want to see their respiration increase, the CO2 respiration. We want to see their water extractable carbon increase, organic nitrogen, water extractable. We want to see that increase. So those are key indicators that tell us that you're headed in the right direction. Important part of that is that we have to change the way we think, not the way we wonder about stuff. We have to actually make changes that matter. And in regenerative agriculture, you've got to take that leap of faith. Nature really does know what it's doing. I need to work with it instead of against it. And that's a challenging thing, but it's something that we're just going to have to do.
Right. I think Kenny Alcibel years ago coined the word kindom, not kingdom. It wasn't like there was a king at the top, but it's we're all kin out here, and everything that's going on, we're not going to overpower anything. We're just going to be with and stay in the flow there. And it seems like what you're doing with your test, Rick, is creating a better scenario for understanding the field conditions. It seems like when there was only a chemical test, it left an underestimation of what goes on in the field or the field conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. You can do a standard test, which I'm not against that. I mean, we do components of the standard test in ours, but it doesn't tell you anything about the life of the soil. That's not something that's going to work. To give you an example, we run tens of thousands of samples through our little lab at the research station, and we see all these different things. We can see farm A and farm B that have the exact same water extractable organic carbon. Let's say it's 300 part per million. And then one of them will have a respiration of 400, and the other one will have one of a respiration of 50. Same food source, and yet they're wildly different in their respiration response. What that tells us is the one that had high respiration with the same carbon really likes that carbon source, and the one that had low respiration with the same amount of carbon didn't really care for that carbon source. And so that's going to tell us that maybe we need to have a different cover crop mix. Maybe we need to get something that they like better. It's like eating cube steak versus filet mignon. If you give them the good stuff, they'll show up.
Right. Yes, exactly. And Rick, before we leave, you could bring this into an economic focus, because someone might balk at testing, but when you look at what you learn from the test and then how your profits can really, really benefit, and it is a direct result, isn't it?
It is, and I'll give you an example. I was giving a talk in Omaha, Nebraska many, many years ago, and I had a farmer stand up at the end of my talk, and he said, well, I ain't giving no $50 for a soil test. And I said, well, I understand that. And I said, that's a lot of money. And he said, yeah, I can get this standard test done for $10. And I said, well, good. I said, that's okay with me. And he said, well, why would I get a $50 test? I said, well, let me ask you this question. I said, if you have 1,000 acres, and it shows that we can save you $20 an acre on nitrogen fertilizer, what would that test worth? And he sat there, I'll never forget this, because he sat there and he goes, well, I'd be a damn idiot if I didn't use that test, wouldn't I? A light bulb came on.
Yes.
He's like, do you want to spend $50 to save $20,000? Yeah, I think the answer is yes. That's the point. If we can grow the same bushels with less fertilizer, how is that a loser? How? That's more money in the farmer's pocket. That's more money in the environment's pocket. You know what I mean? Where's the downside to that?
Absolutely, yes. And now, just in closing, Rick, how satisfied are you with your test? Is there something on the horizon you're looking to be able to measure and garnish more information?
I'm pretty happy with the result. It's a good test, whether it was mine or not. It's just so simple and basic and straightforward. I didn't feel, in all honesty, that that was just me. Those were little epiphanies I had along the way that got put together because I was so focused on what does nature do? How does this work? How can I mimic this? Try to think like a microbe or a plant root. And so I'm pretty happy about that. Now, currently I'm working on some stuff where we can start doing some infield sensing that will give us a little more insight into the dynamics of what's going on in the field as opposed to pulling a sample and sending it to the lab, which is still going to be a very important part. But I'm really wanting to try to get closer to the soil. And that's all pretty exciting to me, is looking at those possibilities for the future.
Sure, absolutely.
And I think you'll find this interesting. I talk to a lot of people, and you see folks that start splitting hairs real quick, like, what's the energy breakdown of this? You know, and it's like, put the plant in the ground, and I guess we'll see. You know,
right.
It's really a fairly simple and straightforward thing. If you want living systems to flourish, give them the right living mixture to do that. And I don't care if you're doing conventional till or no-till, because I've done 10 years of research showing that you can conventionally till. If you're just dead set against no-till, you can conventionally till as long as you use cover crops. So one of the things I've been saying on the circuit is I would rather see a farmer conventionally till and use cover crops than no-till without them. And I think that's an important thing, because years ago, we were at a talk, and there was a bunch of us there, and this guy was like, I don't want to quit conventionally tilling. And it's like, well, you don't have to. Just get the cover crops in the ground. And he was just ecstatic, because by saying, oh, you have to no-till, you have to turn off 80% of the farmers in the country.
Right. It's all about allowing the space for change. You show, yes. You don't tell.
Yeah. Well, change is hard, and I understand that. I understand the pushback against this type of testing because it's different. I get that. I had my first child when I was 50 years old, so I understand that change is hard. But just because it's hard doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. As a matter of fact, just got to think different about it. And this test I developed is not going to be the end all. I mean, there's going to be better tests come up, and that'll be great. But for right now, it's surely going to make you think a little bit different about your soil, and that's really my big goal.
Right.
To just advance the soil health and regenerative movement. It's about all of us as a community moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Alan Williams, John Kempf, and Dr. Rick Haney, leading us into what I hope is a more and more green and wild yonder. All right, here we are. Thanks for making here where we want to be. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com.